Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, Christy, we're going to be talking with Dr. Alan Kachalia, Hospitalist and Director of Quality in the Department of Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital, as well as Associate Medical Director there, about a clear view of patient safety. I hope this clarifies some things because it's so important to all of our patients and us.
So important. But first, we're going to talk about some research that matters. We're going to talk about doctors' views about intensive care at the end of life.
We're going to talk about blood thinners after having a cardiac stent placed.
We're going to talk about what was shocking to me, that today's heroin abusers are often middle-class suburbanites.
And finally, about a walking program if you have peripheral arterial disease or claudication, a home walking program, maybe not even coming in to see the doctor.
Okay, so the first one's about doctors' opinions about intensive care at the end of life. So this was a study done at Stanford University School of Medicine, and they did research surveying nearly 1,100 young doctors who were finishing their training in a variety of different specialties, and nearly 9 out of 10 of the doctors said they would choose a do not resuscitate status near the end of life and would not want high-intensity treatments due to the kind of harm that it causes patients.
You know, and I think, Christy, this is really quite interesting because it is important. A lot of times patients will ask, well, what would you do? But I also say with an ounce of humility that it's really different to ask a doctor kind of a hypothetical question about what would you do at the end of your life than when you're at the end of your life. And so I think that there's an ounce of humility that also says, I might change my mind. I reserve the right to change my mind.
It's true. It is, and you're asking young doctors. And they're fresh to see all that goes on in those intensive care units. And it is true that people die a lot of times in a really unpleasant way that could have been less unpleasant had they just drifted off and we hadn't done all those things to them. So we see the harms that happen from some of those situations.
If you ask me, do I want to suffer and put my family under undue responsibilities and have like prolonged things when it's not going to help? The answer is no. But if you're asking, might I live an extra 3 months in a certain circumstance and maybe the physicians aren't certain, then the answer is, well, probably yes. So part of this also depends on what's the story you're getting told. I do worry that we spend too many resources on people at the end of life, but I also worry that sometimes we give up on people too early. I don't know.
That's true. I often come home from when we're caring for patients in the hospital and remind my husband that I don't want feeding tube. I don't want these things. But it is so different when it's your life in that at that point in time and based on the scenario and facts at the time. So it's a complicated issue.
I also worry a little bit, Christy, that doctors sharing what they would want isn't always the right way of doing it because maybe that's influencing patients.
Or with their patients. Oh, sure.
Yeah,
but
I'd
we should talk to our loved ones about our thoughts about this and be sure that they know what we would want.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about our next research that matters, which is about blood thinners after getting a cardiac stent placement. We should first define what a cardiac stent is.
Okay, so a cardiac stent is when you have these little blood vessels in your heart and where the doctors can go in and put in a little tiny stent, like a little tiny tube that kind of keeps the artery open to allow blood to flow through.
And we make it sound like it's a pretty simple thing, and the cardiologist perhaps can make it sound pretty simple, but it's a big thing.
It's a big deal.
These little blood vessels, if we don't have these little blood vessels, we have big problems. And so these stents, though, really do work, and they open things up really well, and they can prevent major surgery. The question is, after you put them in, do you have to keep them open or else they clot again, which requires you to take a blood thinner, and you got to strap that blood thinner right when you leave the hospital.
Yeah, and that blood thinner is extremely expensive. So it's a really tricky thing because you're supposed to take it, you know, within the first couple days of leaving the hospital for at least a month and in many times for 6 to 12 months, depending on which kind of stent you had. And yet, the medicine is very expensive and hard for a lot of patients to get. And so if you get the stent placed and you can't get the blood thinner, then your risk of a heart attack goes up dramatically.
That's a problem.
That's a problem.
And in this particular study that was in the Journal of the American Heart Association, they found that 30% of people who had these stent placements did not start taking this drug called Plavix or clopidogrel within 3 days of the hospital discharge. And I think you're absolutely right, Christy. It's not so simple as, oh, it's the patient's fault for not taking it. There's a lot of doctor fault here about really, we get patients home so quickly after these major life-changing events. We've got to guarantee that they can do what it is we want them to do.
I know, and it's a shame that the medication is so very expensive. But I wonder what the comparable cost of additional heart attacks for people who can't take it is compared with us being able, or insurance companies or the drug companies being able to provide it, at least for that first month window when they're at the highest risk of having a heart attack.
Yeah, I think bottom line is you're going to, if you've had this or your loved one is, and they place you on this medicine called Plavix or clopidogrel, you need to talk
take
with your
it
doctor.
And take it.
Yeah. Next one, something we don't want you to take, which is heroin. But the surprising thing is how the patterns of heroin use have changed in America.
So heroin used to be a problem of teenagers. You think about teenagers living in impoverished neighborhoods or in the city and just the kinds of problems that happened in the past. But now, apparently, heroin use is more common in whites in their early 20s in the suburbs.
And this was research that was in the Journal of the American Medical Association specialty journal Psychiatry. And it seems to be that the change in heroin use is linked to the abuse of opiate, these medications, oxycodone and hydrocodone and fentanyl, this prescription drug abuse, which people are hooked on these opiates, which have been dramatic increase. And then because those prescriptions are so expensive, they then go to heroin, which is very cheap.
Yeah, it is shocking. And I would want to encourage all of you, if you're taking those painkillers, be sure to talk very openly with your doctor about your habits and your addiction and see if you can come off of them if possible. But certainly, if you're considering switching over to heroin, that is just shocking. And it's worth, I mean, you can get help. There are medications that can help you get off of that addiction and have a life free of those drugs.
Yeah, I think we can't speak too much about the risk of abuse of opiates because the sales of these prescription drugs rose 300% over the last decade. Also, drug overdose deaths tripled during this same time. And then we're seeing this change in heroin use patterns. We'll be talking more about this, but this is a warning flag.
It is. Okay, let's talk about walking. We always talk about walking or exercise or something healthy on the show. And this is about a home-based walking program to help people who have poor blood circulation in their legs.
This research was in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And Christy, I must say, we've actually highlighted a lot of research that's been in the Journal of the American Medical Association. I want to give a call-out kudos. And maybe we have to do these call-out kudos to those doing great research and the journals that are publishing really great research, because this is another good study here about really looking at a simple thing. Can a home exercise program do just as well as an exercise program where you have to come in the doctor or the exercise physiologist for a common problem, which is claudication or blockage of the arteries in the legs?
Yeah, so this peripheral artery disease, or PAD, where those arteries in your legs can get narrow and cause leg pain, make it really painful to walk, especially walking up the steps and that sort of thing. We know that supervised exercise programs can improve your symptoms, but this is a study to first to show that there are positive effects of doing those exercises at home.
Yeah, so about 80 patients who were encouraged to walk at home and 80 patients who just were given kind of general health information, though I find that a little strange as a kind of control because I think we know exercise is helpful. But they found out at the end of a year, those who were in the home walking program actually improved by almost 100 feet in how much they could walk in 6 minutes, while those who did not go in that group actually got worse. And so clear cut, cheap, easy. Well, not necessarily easy because we want to encourage you to walk up to 50 minutes. I know it ain't easy. There's a song to that, isn't there?
But a lot of health benefits to getting some walking in addition to the pain in your legs.
Well, this has been some good research today, Chris. You've been able to talk about exercise and home medication, home walking for those with peripheral arterial disease.
A warning about opiate drugs and a link with heroin abusers in the middle class suburbs.
About blood thinners like Plavix after a stent, it's important to take those medications.
And about doctors' views about intensive care at the end of life. It's complicated.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion. We'll take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Alan Kachalia, Hospitals and Director of Quality in the Department of Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital, about a clear view of patient safety. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Alan Kachalia, Associate Chief Quality Officer at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School, about a clear view of patient safety.
Welcome, Dr. Kachalia.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You know, jumping in and giving our listeners a little background about yourself, tell us how, as a physician, you became interested in patient safety. Of course, we're all interested in patient safety, but how that became your area of research and improvement.
Yeah, I think a lot of it just has to do with mentorship early in my career. As a resident in internal medicine, we had to conduct a research project in order to graduate. And at that time, I was always interested in how things ran, but I ran into a mentor who told me that patient safety was really something that was going to be growing in interest and getting much more attention as we went down and going to become much more important in healthcare. And given that I had an interest in process and how things work, I did my research project in actually how disclosure of errors affects liability. And then when I started my job out of residency, what happened was I got lucky. I stumbled into some great mentorship when I started here at Brigham as a hospitalist. I was actually primary clinical when I started, but my mentors were working in quality and safety, and as I'd expressed an interest in getting into more involved in research and operational work, they kind of helped me go along that route.
Yeah, I'm not sure it was luck, because I think there's some ancient religious wisdom that says, find yourself a teacher, and it sounds like you found yourself several teachers, and so credit to you. I wonder, though, if you could help us as we think about it, because you also wrote this New England Journal of Medicine article about improving patient safety through transparency. Maybe you can help our listeners define two terms for us as we start out. When we talk about medical errors, what are we really talking about? And what are we saying that transparency actually means?
Sure. So medical errors, when we talk about those, there's been a lot of debate around what is the definition of an error. But I think most people, when they think of an error, it means one of two things in general. One is you either just use the wrong plan to achieve a goal that you're trying to get to.
Like what?
Let's say that you decide that you want to treat a pneumonia, and we all know that you're supposed to use one of two. You know, there's a number of antibiotics you can use. But let's say you pick the wrong one in part of your plan. That would be an error in planning.
Okay.
And the second type of error that we talk about is errors of execution, where you're actually going to try to go take out the gallbladder, and you know that you don't want to nick anything nearby, but accidentally in the process of removing the gallbladder, you actually nick something that's close to it.
Or you take out the appendix.
Right. Right. That would be quite a big error, but that's exactly right. So you do the wrong thing. Exactly.
And then what about transparency? How do we define that? What does that mean?
I think that people are still, there's many types of transparency in healthcare because we use that term a lot. And I should point out that we don't ask for transparency just in healthcare. We hear the term being used a lot just in our general everyday life as well. And when we talk about transparency in healthcare, there's a few things I think are just worth mentioning. People talk about price transparency, making sure that consumers understand how much something's going to cost. People also talk about transparency with regard to conflicts of interest that their doctor may have. For example, if your doctor has a patent in a device that he's going to use on you or she's going to use on you, it's important that you know about it and they be transparent about it. But I think when we talk about transparency with regard to medical error, what we're talking about is that when something went wrong, people understood exactly what went wrong in the process and what's going to be done to fix it so that people can understand what happened.
And there's been a big movement over the last several years for transparency of performance measures among hospitals. And could you tell us a little bit about the difference between and the challenges between being transparent about how a hospital or how doctors are performing in their quality compared with the challenges that go into making sure people are transparent with their errors?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think that as people have started talking much more about the importance of quality and safety, I think you know, just to back up a little bit, we've talked about the fact that we need better systems of care. We've learned that measurement is critical to all of this. We've also learned that we need what people call a just culture, meaning that there's balance for accountability, that if you made a mistake that anybody else could have made and you were trying your hardest, that's where we need to fix the system. Whereas if you're making errors because you've been reckless, there should be some level of individual accountability. And in trying to tackle all these three types of issues, I think people have started to realize that everybody needs to know how care is delivered and when things go wrong, what happened. And that's where transparency comes in, and people believe that we just need to let people know exactly how things are happening. And I think what's been great is that it all got started, or a lot of it got a big push when CMS started this public reporting of measures and mandating it. I think you guys have all heard of Hospital Compare, where you can log into the website and you can see how hospitals are doing on certain publicly reported measures. For example, with regard to heart attack-related care or pneumonia-related care, you can actually see how well a hospital does on process and outcome measures in that regard. And I think most of us agree that that is a great start with regard to transparency, because what it's asking people to do is measure. What it's asking people to do is then improve, because I think nobody wants to be seen as lagging behind their peers.
Well, you know, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, it seems that some of what you're talking about and some of what's happening, particularly with like these large electronic medical records, which collect so much data, is we're improving transparency through better patient safety. I'm not convinced yet, and you're going to convince me, I hope. How are we improving patient safety through transparency, which is really what the title of your article is, because it seems as if that is much more difficult, many more barriers.
I think you're right, and I'd argue that we're still struggling with improving care through just public reporting as well, because as important as public reporting is, you still need people to try to improve the measures underneath it, and we're getting there, but when it comes to discussing error, being transparent with error, it comes with a whole host of other issues, because when somebody is injured, it's a lot harder to talk about the event for both the providers and the patients. And I think some people argue that human inclination is to not want to talk about it. And there's other problems that come with it, which is that one is the providers have the added burden of worrying about what it means to them from a liability standpoint. They worry about how it'll look with their peers.
And what do we know about that? I mean, clearly some doctors and hospitals might fear being transparent about their error for fear of legal action or the patient being so angry. But what do we know about transparency of medical errors and liability?
I think we know we know a little bit, and we're constantly learning more. I'm sure that you've heard of what people were calling disclosure, apology, and offer programs, which often people are now calling communication and resolution programs. And the idea behind programs like this that have gained a lot of interest over the recent years is that if the institution or the provider makes a mistake, or actually it actually starts when something just goes wrong with the patient, what the institution or the provider will do is they'll go in and tell the patient, look, we know that you've been hurt, we're very sorry about this, but what we're going to do is we're going to conduct an investigation to tell you what happened here. That's the transparency piece here. And what follows from that, they'll say, is that, and if we realize it's our mistake, we will take responsibility for it, and actually they will apologize to the patient. And then many institutions take it to the next level, which is that if it was their mistake, after apologizing, they'll actually make an offer of compensation. I think when programs like this were first being advocated, people were skeptical as to whether or not they would actually harm what they would do with regard to the liability impact. And there's some early data to show from the VA, Lexington VA, and the University of Michigan, to show that after these institutions implemented these types of programs, their liability experience on the whole actually improved rather than worsened.
So people were less likely to sue if they felt like they understood what happened than that people were being upfront?
Yeah. Both institutions, what they saw was a drop in the number of claims that they had to pay, and what both institutions saw was a drop in the amount of dollars they were paying out in total compensation to their patients. And at Michigan, they did see a drop in the amount of claims that they were paying. Because what they found is their patients and other local attorneys then started trusting the institution more as well, when they said, look, we looked into it, it wasn't our fault, they actually took them at have started taking them at their word more.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we continue, we're going to continue talking with our guest, Dr. Alan Cachalia, Associate Chief Quality Officer, Brigham and Women's Hospital, and Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School, about a clearer view of patient safety. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Christy and I have been having a conversation with Dr. Alan Cachalia, Associate Chief Quality Officer at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and also Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School, about a clear view of patient safety. And Dr. Cachalia, you were mentioning some of the barriers, and I guess these hit home, about the difficulty of disclosing errors, because sometimes the only person who really knows an error has been made is the doctor. The patient doesn't know it. The system may not know it. You've put someone on heparin, and you perhaps didn't monitor their levels in their blood, and they had a bleed. You gave them a medicine that maybe they're allergic to, and maybe no one noticed it. And it, you know, I made mistakes when I was an intern, when I was the youngest of the youngest.
But nonsense, right?
You know, and you carry this burden with you. What do we do to help that feeling of, I can't admit it, because, I mean, you're up in the Mecca of Harvard. I mean, I can't even imagine what it'd be like to make a mistake up there, much less down here in the southern paradise of heaven. What do we do?
Well, trust me, we make mistakes up here as well. I think what you're getting at is that when we talk about being transparent, I think what we need to realize is that when things go wrong like this, we need to be sensitive to both, just not the patient's feelings, but the provider's feelings. And the way you do this is the institution needs to constantly and consistently make it clear that they want people to step up and talk about their mistakes. And they need to make it clear to people that when they do, they will support them in it, and that they won't punish them if it was a true systems error. And that takes an ongoing and concerted effort to make that change happen.
Do you have an example?
Well, I think we continue to work on that here. We've had providers who have made mistakes where they've actually, as you mentioned, they had a drug-drug interaction and they missed when another drug got added to a patient's regimen and they didn't necessarily monitor the way they would have liked. Or we've had IV lines get switched here. And what we've tried to do in those cases where it was clearly a systems type of issue, we've supported our providers as we talked about what went wrong in this issue.
You know, we're talking about fear of the doctors and the nurses. Let's talk about the fear of the patients. The patients go into the hospital when they're at their most vulnerable time, trusting the doctors and nurses and team and reputation of the hospital or whatever. And now there's all this stuff that, hey, we're making mistakes and we don't know what we're doing, and just sort of maybe an impression to the patients that they shouldn't trust us quite so much. What do you advise for patients to navigate the systems to reduce errors to themselves and also to engender trust?
So, and we struggle with this issue a lot as we try to be more transparent around putting some of our performance data up on our hospital screen so that patients can see it as well. You know, the last thing patients want to see is that the hospital is not getting everything perfectly right every single time. But the reality is that's how it is in healthcare today. So what we try to explain to our patients is that we will always be honest and open with them. And that's the piece I think that people always look for. Because if you look at survey data today, I think a lot of patients understand that mistakes will happen in healthcare. And I think most people, if we understand mistakes are going to happen, what we want is when that mistake happens, we want people to be honest and open with us. And that's what we try to reassure them that we will do. We also think transparency is really important because when things go wrong, it can help with closure and it can help families move on if they actually really know what happened. So these are two ways in which we think it can actually help patients, you know, understand what happens in care. And I think if they also understand what kind of mistakes can happen, they can be more engaged in their care and help us intercept them earlier on, is our hope.
Well, we typically in the past have had what's called these morbidity and mortality conferences where physicians gather around and we discuss a case and we talk about it. We don't really involve, as far as I ever know, patients in this process. And I'm wondering, Christy asked this question about patient empowerment. Are the processes that are happening now that you're talking about and you're working on, are they actually involving patients in these processes to help design better systems like all of the rest of medicine's trying to do?
We do. There are many cases. We actually have a patient and family advisory committee here, and we do take issues to them. And we have patients on several of our committees here that are trying to help us improve our processes. And in these cases where if a patient or patient was involved in an error, we do talk with the family about the solution as we go forward in it. So, yes, we are trying to get them more involved in the process.
I think it makes sense for patients to know about medical errors for a variety of reasons. And you highlighted one, enclosure and being able to move on. But tell us more about Adam's question earlier, this link between transparency, which sounds like it makes sense, and truly having safer patients. Is it all about the systems? Is it about the perception? How are you so convinced that being more transparent will make our patients safer?
So I think there's two big ways that I think it can really help make our patients safer. One is we've realized that in the patient safety movement, we still need to get people to understand how frequently errors occur and why they occur. And the best way to make that happen is that when something goes wrong, to openly discuss it. Because it's through this open discussion that you can facilitate these concerted efforts we need to try to fix the break or fix the error that occurred. So I think it's with openness and that open discussion, people telling us what really happened, is the only way we can actually get to a solution that will fix it or prevent it in the future.
You know, go ahead.
And I think the second way it can get at it is that if an institution knows that it's going to be transparent about the mistakes that occur, our hope is that they'll be a little bit more proactive around issues and new processes that they launch because they know that they'll be open about this and they want to prevent the error from to begin with.
It reminded me, we spoke not too long ago with Dr. Victor Zhao, former chancellor of Duke University Health System, and he talked about when Duke had this problem a few years ago with faulty equipment and hydraulics being used in grease oil rather than, and no patients were injured, but there was, I'm sure, some large litigation. But what they did with it ultimately was they decided they were going to be one of the top institutions in the country on patient safety. And
right.
That to me was the great, you know, thing so that you can take that mistake. And I guess let's take a look at something modern today, and maybe you have some thoughts on it. The VA medical system, clearly huge number of errors and problems with transparency. How do you apply what you're talking about to a system, a large system, where the mistakes aren't maybe at an individual level, they're at a system level?
Yeah, that's quite a challenge that, as we all know, they have going on there in the VA. I think a lot of this starts with leadership. The leadership has to kind of set the stage on, we'll be transparent, but of course transparent means being open and honest about what they're seeing. And I think if you have your leaders setting that standard for everybody in this institution, it will percolate throughout the institution. So I think part of being transparent is being honest and open, and that, I think that comes from leaders setting that stage.
I know you're doing some work around communication and resolution. Tell us about that work and where people can find out more information about that.
Right. So as I mentioned earlier, we have these disclosure, apology, and offer programs that are gaining more interest, and again, as a means for transparency and as a means for making a patient whole when something goes wrong. And more and more people I want to do this, but what people are finding is it's not just how to implement programs like this is not easy. So I'm actually part of this group called the Massachusetts Alliance for Communication and Resolution Following Medical Injury, long name. I think the short abbreviation is MACRME, where we talk about what do patients and providers need to know when errors happen and how do you go about communicating and resolving issues like this. This alliance actually has a website that people can go to for more information.
What is that website?
It's www.macrme.info, and MACRME is MACRMI.info.
And that could apply for patients who are concerned about a medical error involving themselves or a loved one to learn how to approach their doctors, or will that apply for patients all over the place?
Yeah, no, I think this has information for both patients and providers as to how people are trying to commit to transparent communication and resolution. Yeah.
Great.
That's great. If you have one final tip for patients and one final tip for providers who may be listening to us today, what would it be in order to improve patient safety through transparency or really have a clear view of patient safety?
I'd say for patients, I think the tip is don't be afraid to ask questions of your provider if you're worried about anything. I think most providers today are really committed to letting you know what goes on. And for providers, I think if, when things go wrong, let's continue to lead on being much more transparent with our patients and to not be afraid to seek out support resources within your organization because they can help you do this the right way.
Great.
Great. That's super.
Thank you so much for taking time to talk with us and share with our listeners and for the safety work that you're doing.
No, it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for taking the time.
We've been talking with Dr. Alan Kachalia, Associate Chief Quality Officer at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School, about a clear view of patient safety. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
If you have a question or comment or concern you'd like Christy and I to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And Christy, we have some excellent house calls today about pregnancy and safe zones and high school sports and concussions and lots of other stuff. So let's have Erica Lloyd, our executive producer, read us our very first house call today.
I'm about to enter my second trimester of pregnancy. I'm eager to enter the safe zone as I had a miscarriage a little over 1 year ago. I was really into CrossFit, but stopped when I found out I was pregnant. My doctor said it would be okay for me to continue since it was part of my normal routine prior to pregnancy, but I'm afraid this could make me miscarry. What advice do you have for me?
Christy, you should first off define what the safe zone is.
Well, I think that's a term that women use in once you get to the second trimester, just because you're less likely to have a miscarriage if the pregnancy has carried on for that far. So we're sorry that you suffered from a miscarriage in the past, but glad that you are feeling good enough to get back into exercise and that you've made it to the second trimester.
And I'm not familiar with a lot of research, Christy, and you're the expert here, but I'm not familiar with a lot of research that says that the first trimester miscarriages are due to, you know, people doing their normal exercise.
No.
I think that's probably good for you.
Yeah. So we encourage people to continue with their exercise regimens during pregnancy, and especially, and, you know, huge shout out to CrossFit. I'm totally into CrossFit. So you, whoever listener who wrote in, we can talk about this offline sometime. But we have a lot of people in our gym who continue their CrossFit, continue their weightlifting, adapt it based on, you know, what's happening with your body to do less weight and do some alternate movements, but are able
running, swimming.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I have a relative very close to me who did her CrossFit all the way up until the week before she delivered. And one day she beat the boys when she was running. I laughed. But it's good to stay fit, especially if you were already doing that activity beforehand. So what your doctor said is the general rule of thumb. If you're already doing an exercise activity, to continue it during pregnancy is okay. You don't want to just all of a sudden take up a new sport because you're probably going to pull something or hurt yourself.
Don't want to start playing baseball during the third trimester.
No.
And when do you recommend at all that folks stop their exercise or alter it? Any time in the pregnancy, 37 weeks, 38 weeks, or no?
I think people have to pay attention to their bodies and you know, pay attention to the cues that your body is giving you. But there are a lot of people who are big time runners who continue to run and
run those road races.
You
right
see them on the road. It's amazing. And I wish I had when I was pregnant, but I didn't. I was so out of shape.
I'd be nervous, but I'll listen to my doctor on this one.
Yeah.
Erica,
well,
what's our very next house call?
My son plays high school sports and received 2 concussions last year. I'm worried about future problems this could cause him, so much so that I'm contemplating whether or not I should let him continue to play. I would appreciate your thoughts.
You're a good parent, and I have to say, my children aren't old enough to have, so I haven't crossed this bridge as a parent. As a just considering it, it makes me nervous too. 2 concussions in a year, and we know a lot of the bad outcomes that can happen related to concussions, and that would make me nervous too. But yet, if your son is really into it and that's a part of his life, there are a lot of benefits from sports too. So it's a complicated one.
I don't know, Chrissy. I've the more research than we've had, some of the great experts in the country here talking about concussions here. And you didn't tell us which sport it was, but it could have been cheerleading. It could have been football. It could have been basketball. It could have been
soccer. Get him to take up tennis or golf, maybe?
Yeah, I would do one of these other sports. So I must say golf, Christy. I did have an episode once where I hit a golf ball out of a sand trap, and the ball went up in the air pretty high, and I didn't see it. I'm looking around. Everyone looked at me, and all of a sudden, that golf ball hit me on the head.
That explains everything, Adam.
There is no safe sport. But I think in all seriousness, two concussions, same sport, same year. You know, the question would be, you know, very few kids are going to play college sports competitively, and even fewer, negligibly few, would go on beyond that. So the question is, can you play a different sport? Take some time off, because a third concussion there really risks, to me, some irreversible things that could happen. So I'm very nervous.
Okay. Well, we wish you all the best. That is a complicated family decision that really needs to be made with the values of your family and in trying to respect your son and his wishes as well. And we wish you the best as you make that decision.
Erica, what's our very next house call?
As the weather gets warmer, my husband turns on our ceiling fan at night to stay cool. I have trouble with dry eyes to begin with, but this makes it so much worse. He doesn't like the thought of leaving our windows open, and we try our best not to run the AC all night. Other than eye drops, what can I do to prevent waking up with dry eyes?
This sounds like my life. My husband loves the ceiling fan. I cannot stand the ceiling fan. Like, I can't stand it. And one time we thought about getting a fan that would just blow on him so that I could not have the fan.
Well, you could have a little personal fan.
Exactly. Let him have his little fan blow right on him. But anyway.
Or someone stand over him who just,
fans him
all night.
That's the answer. One idea when I read your house call is that you could use the drops, but also put a little eye mask on or something to cover your eyes at night so that fan's not blowing right on your lids.
Yeah, I think also I would look and see other things that could be contributing to dry eyes too, because
there
are things that you and others can or may do that, like medicines that have antihistamines in them. Some people take Benadryl for sleep or antihistamines that can dry you out, like Allegra or other things for allergies, side effects of some of these SSRIs for depression and mood. I would really look and see, are there some other things that could be going on here? You know, regular natural tear eye drops are also, you know, good to use.
Yeah, they're not going to hurt you. Well, that sounds like a complicated negotiation in your marriage, and we do wish you all the best as y'all sort that out.
You don't want a different spouse, do you, Christy?
No.
You want to keep your...
No, I'll take the ceiling fan to keep my sweet husband.
I'm going to tell him that. Erica, what's our very last house call?
My dad is in his late 50s, and he's always on the go. He's one of those people who can't stand idle time. If he isn't at work, he's landscaping the backyard all day long. He's always outside during the heat of the day, and I really worry that he could one day have a heat stroke or possibly go into cardiac arrest. Can you offer any advice aside from keeping him hydrated?
Christy, this sounds way too similar to me. Did my daughter write this house call? Did she write in here? I don't know. This sounds like a lot of men probably.
Well, I think you should feel very good and proud of your father for doing landscaping and being physically active and being outside, because those are good habits to have for overall wellness and for exercise and staying fit. So if you can reframe a little bit to at least have some pride in, for him for being so active.
But, you know, staying outside during the middle of the heat of the day, I mean, when it's in the 90s out there, as it is a lot of the summer here in the South and a lot of areas of the world today, I think, you know, between, you know, 11 a.m. and 4 p.m., that's the heat of the day. And so one can avoid those extremes, do one's landscaping in the early morning and the late afternoon, wear a broad-brimmed hat, and keep that water bottle. I see a lot of my women friends, they've got water around them a lot, and a lot of my men friends rarely do.
Yeah, and think about, maybe you can pick an area for him to landscape that's in the shade.
Yeah, that's right. Big plants, those big trees, big palm trees. Except I think if you're like some of my friends, we'll sit down in the shade.
Yeah.
We'll have something else maybe besides water there, like a soda.
Well, you should talk with your father openly about your concerns and make sure you get him a little water bottle or something that'll stay connected to his pants.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls, and we want to thank all of you for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. You can share your own questions at yourhealth@unc.edu or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or search for our health app.
We want to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Alan Kachalia. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We will look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Presented by UNC Family Medicine.